Are you searching for an education that forms not just the mind, but the soul? At Thomas More College of Liberal Arts, we believe learning should be more than just getting a degree. It should be about discovering truth, beauty, and virtue. Located in the beautiful and historic Merrimack Valley, Thomas More College is a Catholic liberal arts college dedicated to the great books and the pursuit of wisdom. But here students don't just study philosophy, theology, literature, history and classical languages. They engage in lively discussions in small, close-knit classes, guided by devoted professors. And they don't just learn about faith, they live it. Through a vibrant Catholic community, daily mass, and a curriculum rooted in the teachings of the Church. Every student at Thomas More College also spends a full semester in Rome, at no extra cost beyond tuition. In the heart of Christendom, they walk the same streets as saints and scholars, study in the shadow of St. Peter's Basilica, and experience Catholic culture in a way that no textbook ever could. If you, or someone you know, is looking for an education that challenges the intellect and nourishes the soul, visit thomasmorecollege.edu to learn more. Thomas More College. Experience more. Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashington. The death of a pope, the election of a new pope, are two of the most dramatic things that can happen in the life of the Church and affect every Catholic. But of course, they also have implications for the whole of the rest of the world. Edward Pentin is a well-known journalist and author. He specialises in covering the papacy and the Catholic Church. He's been Rome correspondent for several publications, including EWTN's National Catholic Register and Newsweek. His expertise and extensive contacts in the Vatican have made him an invaluable source for understanding the inner workings of the Church. He was author of that enormously important book, The Next Pope, The Leading Cardinal Candidates. Edward's been in Rome for the conclave and had a bird's eye view of everything that's taken place. As we reflect on the election of Leo XIV, we've asked Edward to join us to look back over his time in Rome and the process that lay behind Leo's election and share his perspective with us. I'm very pleased to say he joins me now. Edward, thank you so much for joining us this morning. It's wonderful to see you. These must have been 10 of the most amazing days of your life, I would think. If I can just say, how are you? How's it been?
Yes, it's been fascinating and momentous. Yes, definitely. It's something I'll never forget. It's been quite something to be in the thick of it here at this historic time, because it really is. As we know, it was a crucial conclave, this one. I mean, they always are, but this one particularly so, I think. And so it's quite something to be there.
Yeah. When I heard the result, after a short while, I found a sense of oppression lifting, a sense of cognitive dissonance disappearing, a joy coming. And I thought, I'm not sure I'm entitled to all this, but nothing that's happened since has changed my mind. You've been one of the people right at the heart of the whole process. You wrote a book about the Papabile people. Was Cardinal Bob one of your original runners?
Well, no, because he came. He's only been a cardinal for 2 years, so or less than 2 years. So he didn't really appear on anyone's radar until very recently. I've actually known of him for many years because I made a documentary with a friend of mine, Raphael Schmidt, back in 2008 on Pope Benedict XVI. And one of the people we interviewed for that documentary was Father Robert Prevost, when he was head of the Augustinian Order, because, of course, Pope Benedict had a great devotion to St. Augustine. And so he went to Pavia, the tomb of St. Augustine, in 2007 with Pope Benedict, and they celebrated Vespers together. So we interviewed him, and we have a nice little clip of him in the documentary, of him talking about St. Augustine and Benedict and Benedict's devotion to St. Augustine. So I've known of him for many years, and he's always been, I've always thought, you know, he was a very sort of calm, then very sort of, he'd sort of exhibited a certain holiness then. And so it's nice to see him. One sort of followed him over the years, going to back to Peru and then into the Congregation for Bishops. So it's been interesting following him. But nobody really thought he was Papable until, I think, the sort of the last few weeks, really, of before the conclave.
Yeah. I'm so glad you said he exhibited a certain holiness, because I've been accusing myself of being naive. I was on LBC, just a rather humble London radio show, and they saying, well, so now you've talked to us about the issues before he came. Now you've got your Pope. Where is he on the spectrum of things you've described to us? I had talked about cultural appeasement and cultural resistance rather than trying to get around the left and the right thing.
Right.
And I just went all gooey, and I said, he's not anywhere on it. He's just like Jesus. I mean, there is a holiness to him, and all the categories that we've been playing with are simply to some extent redundant, because there's something about him that is authentic and and required at the moment. And all I can tell you is that when he prays and when he speaks, I feel we have a Catholic Pope, and I'm terribly happy about it. There's a holiness. So when you know, we could talk politically, we could talk pneumatically, but when you say there's a certain holiness about him, can I ask you to expand a bit so I feel a bit less naive and my sort of instincts are being ratified by somebody who knows more about him than I do?
Yes, I mean, not much more, though, because, I mean, we didn't, it's a very brief interview. I'm trying to get the full tape, actually, because obviously there's more to it than we used. But I just got the sense from him that he did have that a certain special character to him. And the fact that I remember thinking at the time, you know, he's head of the Augustinian order. He was quite young then. I mean, this was going back, nearly 20 years. So he was quite young and still had got to that very key responsibility and seemed to be popular too as a leader of the Augustinians. So I did pick up a sense a little bit of maybe he was quite liberal. I don't know why. I picked up a little sense about that. Maybe because the Augustinian order, there are elements of it which have gone quite liberal. And so I thought, that may be something to bear in mind. But on the whole, I had a very good impression of him. Yeah.
Well, I think 20 years ago, people who met me might have not that I'm comparing myself to him, but I remember I had really quite a liberal stage as the river of spirituality and theology meandered its way through the decades. So we'll have to see. But yes. To help me understand the fact that when he was announced, the Conservatives said, "This is great. We can live with this." And all the progressives said, "We've got our man. This is great. We can live with this." Now, to interpret that, please.
Yes. I mean, this, I think, speaks well. Who knows? I mean, I think one of the interpretations is that this clearly is the Holy Spirit at work, because he's someone who can bridge the gaps. He's somebody who is who can be a unifier and a peacemaker. And so there is this sense that he, you know, he is the Pope that we need at this time, with all of the divisions and polarizations within the church and in society. And so what we needed, and I think a lot of us were saying before the conclave, what we needed was a Pope like this, somebody that I felt they were going to choose somebody like this, primarily because that's what we needed, somebody who's calm, brought some serenity, somebody who's reasonable, kind, and would bring sides together, and that seems to be exactly what we have. So I think it's an answer to prayer. I think a lot of people think he's an answer to prayer, but it was a surprise, as we say, and because he wasn't on many people's probably lists. And what was interesting was that, you know, in the days before the conclave, you had very prominent liberal figures, that's for want of a better word, who were saying that, predicting that he was going to be elected and rooting for him, clearly. So I think a lot of people on the more conservative side of the church were a little disappointed when he was elected. I think there was a sense that, you know, the liberals got their man, but it's not as clear as that. And I think, as I say, he manages to seem to transcend these sides of the church and try to bring the sides together, which I think is something that people want to see. And that's why he has this great broad appeal, I think.
I'd like to try out one of my instincts on you to see if you agree. I mean, I think I was disappointed when I heard of the arguments between him and Vance over Ordo Amoris. In one sense, of course, theologically, they're both right. The Pope is right in saying Jesus nowhere invites us to make this kind of hierarchical distinction. And we know that within the Gospels, family is a contested concept for all kinds of particularly and distinctive reasons that have to do with the Sitzenleben of the time. Mm-hmm. And yet at the same time, Vance and Augustine are right. We have to do some hard work to talk about loving our neighbor as ourselves requires a bit of unpacking and prioritizing. So in one sense, they're both right. I have no difficulty with that. The thought that the Pope might be critical of the American government for its attempt to regain control of its borders in some other circumstances would have depressed me. I think under Francis, I would have been quite depressed. In fact, I still mistrust the political initiative that was taken when Francis went down there and said, "Build bridges, not walls." I don't think what we saw was WYSIWYG, particularly because there was a sense that somehow the Catholic Church was involved in being a beneficiary of the work the cartels were doing to smuggle people, which leaves us with an ethical taste in our mouth that is worse than awful. But when I heard that the prevost might take a kind of left-leaning, I didn't seem to mind very much. I found myself saying, well, okay, they can have a political argument if they want. That doesn't matter. What matters is, and then I suppose a whole list of things like that have begun already, rescuing the JP2 Institute for the Family, giving some hope for those who love the Mass of the Ages, dealing with, I don't know, did Rupnik ever flee to Brazil, or was that fake news? But if he hasn't fled to Brazil, he ought to flee to Brazil. And I was, there are a whole load of cleaning the Augean stable stuff that needed to take place that I was much more exercised by as a Catholic. What was your take on these issues as they presented themselves?
Yes, well, I think it's so far, it shows that he has, one thing that comes across very much, and I was speaking to somebody who's in the Vatican yesterday about him, who knows him, who's got to know him fairly well, and he says, you know, he's a man who listens very carefully, and he listens to those people who he knows know better than him, which is a good sign, because, you know, he's happy to take advice and listen to those experts. And I think it shows with the decisions he's taken so far. And I think I'm quite sure that he knows a lot about all the problems that we all know in the church. I can't imagine that he's not aware of them. And I think what the decisions he's taken so far show that he is aware of them, and will do something about them. Whether he takes the strong decisions that we would like and expect, I don't know. I think he wants to be a bridge builder. He's a peacemaker. He's not going to upset one side or the other. I think he may toe a middle line. Some people think that he might sort of be a sort of a little bit like a sort of Justin Welby and muddle along, you know, like as we know in the Anglican Church. But who knows? We'll know soon enough. One of the things that will be very revealing are his appointments and how he those are going to be very telling about what the direction he wants to take the church. So
what have we had so far? We have had, and it was interesting that the head of the I don't know whether it was because of the scandal of the mural or not, but But there was a change. The John Paul II Institute for the Family was perhaps his first major appointment, and as far as I could see, a very good one. What was your judgment? Yeah.
No, exactly. I've just written a piece about this. It wasn't so surprising. Archbishop Pallier, the outgoing Grand Chancellor of the John Paul II Institute, is 80. He was 80 on, and I think in April. So he was up to retire very soon. And it's said that Pope Francis would have probably chosen the Vicar General of Rome anyway, who was the traditional Grand Chancellor. So it's not necessarily surprising, but what is what's interesting is it's one of his first appointments, and it was one that was seen as very long overdue. And anyone who's followed the John Paul II Institute and what was done to it will be aware that it was a very traumatic time. It was the institute was effectively gutted. John Paul's legacy was trashed, really. The way they handled it, the way they got rid of very good tenured staff, and really, it was in many ways, many considered a scandal and caused a lot of upset and pain. So to make that as one of the first appointments probably shows that he gets that and he wants to see changes there, and the institute brought back to how it was originally.
And the symbolism is multifaceted. It's not just the JP II Institute on the Family, but it's also the legacy of John Paul II, which is taking care of. Let me ask you about a couple of my other judgments. My sense was that two of the real weaknesses that we faced under the legacy that Francis left us with were the ambiguity about same-sex relationships and the threat of synodal chaos. So as an Anglican, I've been hugely exercised by the synodal question because the ploy, the political ploy that it was intended to produce was both obvious and extremely effective, and it was immensely frustrating to see the Catholic Church simply copying what the Anglican Communion had done in such a labored but horribly effective way. And it looked like there might be no way of stopping a doctrinal car crash predicated on the Trojan horse of pastoral compassion. But of course, one of the things I tried to argue was that the synodal process its integrity depends entirely on how it's defined. And synodality can be exercised as a form of consultation within proper structures of doctrinal authority, and be an antidote to such levels of polarization. I was absolutely thrilled when I heard the Pope talk about synod. Well, he did two things. First of all, he mentioned synodality. We're a synodal church. And I thought, oh, no. No, no, this is the legacy of Francis. But almost immediately he began to define his terms. And his terms were very different indeed from what we'd been given before. And I just relaxed and thought, that's fine. He gets it. He's doing what I would expect him to do. He's purchasing the continuity ticket because you have to do that. Any sensible grown-up running an organization has to do continuity if at all possible.
Right.
But he's explaining what it really means and what it could mean. He's not captive to the past, which did you see the same dynamic at play? And is there more to it than that?
Yes. And I've heard the similar as well from others who've followed this and followed what he said about synodality. I think there is probably a willingness on his part to clarify what synodality is. As people have often said, you know, we don't know what synodality really means. Nobody's properly defined it. And it seems like he's going to do that, and he's going to do it in a very Catholic way and make synodality what it probably should be in terms of, you know, how Paul VI wanted the synods to be, and bring it back to that and make it very much respectful of the bishops, for one thing, and then and make it really useful for the church in the way that it should be, you know, it could be, without undermining the hierarchy of the church, which is what many fear it is doing, especially with these assemblies which are planned for 2028, which will involve laity and bishops, and it'll be like a sort of parliament. And I think there's a lot of unease about that it's going to, that it upsets the natural hierarchy of the church, which is, you know, goes back to Christ. So I think that's the hope, but we have to see. So far we only have these terms to go on. We haven't seen real action yet, so we have to wait for that action, I think, to see how he's going to really play this.
It does seem to me that if I can just escape the fear that the whole process of ambiguity that Pope Francis launched left me with, that synodality itself could be Catholic synodality as well as Anglican synodality, and the distinction between them is quite, just as you said, Anglican synodality mimics a democratic process by which the synod gets to change the nature of the church. Catholic right. synodality invites contributions from different gifted people without any implication that they can possibly have doctrinal consequence, because they can't have doctrinal consequence. That's not the Catholic way. So one of the things that I found myself saying is I can see a very strong case for Catholic synodality.
Yes.
It's too easy for the laity to sit back and just go to Mass. It's too easy to allow a certain clericalization to develop because of the extraordinary charism that the priesthood has in bringing us the body and blood of Christ. It's too easy to allow the strength of the Catholic Church to act as a form of disablement unnecessarily. And actually, synodality can become a form of an antidote to that form of disability, so long as
yes.
it isn't given this politicized process, and it's thought that people whom you're consulting have the capacity to change the doctrine of the church, which, since they have no qualifications to do so,
right.
would be ludicrous. So, but I think, unless I miss, you know, I heard him make those distinctions, and I thought, well, that's fine, in which case they can do what they like in 1928. They can gather as many feminist professors of theology as they want from the highways and the byways. They can listen to them and consult them and enjoy their company and learn a bit of gosh, what was that woman in the 1970s? Reuter, Rosemary Radford Reuter. She was the great feminist, Catholic feminist of the 70s. Let them enjoy it, but so long as everyone understands that Catholic doctrine is formed as Catholic doctrine is always formed,
exactly.
and the oil and water don't mix. Synodality and doctrine have nothing to do with each other. So
right.
I found myself persuaded of that really quite early on. Once I'd heard him do what I thought he was intending to do, which was to send out signals to people, look, it's okay, I've got this. I know what the distinctions are. You don't have to worry. The age of chaos and ambiguity is over. And
yes.
that does seem to me to be the strongest thing that's come out of the way in which he presents itself.
Well, one theory, Gavin, is that it's only a theory, but he might make synodality into two strands. So you have the Synod of Bishops, which is what we now understand as Synod,
of course.
Synod of Bishops from the past. And then you'd have synodality for the laity and for the others. But those wouldn't be sort of capable of changing, obviously, any doctrine or anything, but they would be a discussion chamber, for example. But you'd have the proper synod of bishops taking the decisions, and so with the Pope, of course. So that would be a way, I think, that he may be able to sort this out. Who knows? But that's
what I'm reminded of Winnie the Pooh and the psychological types that Winnie the Pooh very astutely ascribes to different animals. And that, you know, there are ecclesiastical rabbits, people who need to go around being awfully busy with committees, and
yes.
it helps them enormously to feel that they're contributing to the life of the church by being on committees. They're so mm-hmm. welcome to it. But so long as the committee is given no power at all, it allows them a degree of sort of therapeutic self-expression without any consequences to the church. The problem with Anglicanism is, of course, is that it confused the therapeutic powers of feeling important with actually giving to people who are not qualified the capacity to change the nature of the church. And as you rightly say, if the bishops retain to themselves the functionality, the exercise of episcopal office, and they don't delegate it to social workers amongst the laity, then all is safe and well. What about same-sex blessings, fiducia supplicans? Do you think? I mean, clearly he's said very in a very straightforward way that he understands the requirements of the gospel to stand in contradistinction to secular fashion, and that simply knocks the whole thing about progressing towards gay marriage and gay blessings on the head. What's he likely to do you think, about the about fiducia supplicans, the apostolic exhortations, the so-called Francis Magisterium, as Cardinal Tucho told us it was to be taken as? Is he likely to ignore it, confront it, reroute it? Something's got to be done.
Well, he's already spoken about this when he was head of bishops, and he said that it should be delegated basically to the bishops to deal with. That was his sort of answer, that it was up to them to enforce it or reject it or whatever, which is very much a synodal way of, I suppose, of dealing with it. But it's not clear exactly what he really thinks about it. I think there's something that's come out recently about how he said it was, you know, it's part of the teaching authority of the church, so it needs to be respected. But I don't know. I think he may have said those things because he was part of the Curia, and, you know, he was part of Pope Francis's close advisors there. So
he was on team, wasn't he? What else could he do?
So he had to sort of say these things. But whether, as Pope, he's going to really go along with it, I don't know. I have my doubts. I think that I was talking to an African bishop recently, and he was saying that he felt that it'll just be ignored. At least that's the hope among the African bishops. I think that they hope that it's just going to be ignored. But then others are saying, well, it needs more than that. It needs a total refutation. You know, it's going down the wrong path. It's really undermining the moral teachings of the church, and so it needs to have some sort of correction. So we'll just have to see. It's impossible really to predict, but I would say, looking at him, he's going to play it very carefully, try not to upset one side or the other, but try to take the toxicity of it out of it somehow. I don't know. I think that's probably what he'll try to do.
I mean, psychologically and theologically, I belong to the camp who would like it dealt with and knocked on the head very quickly and said, "Let's, you know, we're resetting to 212." But there are two parts to any of us. That's the emotional part. There's a political part where I can see that in a way, rather like a judo player using the weight of his opponent against him, the fact that so much of the Francis Magisterium was clothed in ambiguity means that what we're left with is ambiguity, and you can't rely on ambiguity.
Right.
So, in which case, it provides nothing to build on because it was ambiguous, and therefore the Leo IX Magisterium will simply build over it, and you know, just don't drink from this particular part of the estate. The water's not been purified, but otherwise, you know, there's yellow tape around it. Move on.
Well, I think there's hope, Gavin, in the fact that he's an Augustinian, and I think, I mean, you know better than I do, but I think with Augustine, he is clear on these things, especially on sexual ethics and so forth. So I think I would hope that would give him, that would make him very clear in his teaching. And already we're seeing that. I think he's, you know, he's willing to draw on much deeper sources than Francis used to, you know, going back to the Church Fathers and Leo the 13th, of course, and so forth. So I think that gives grounds for hope. that there's going to be a lot of clarity through this.
At an anecdotal level, have you seen that lovely, that very interesting video where he's confronting a Peruvian crowd of laity who are very cross about something? And my Spanish is is non-existent. From time to time, he says, "I'm your bishop. I'm not having this, and I will not deal with fake news." And there's a sort of it's actually a hugely impressive example of managing a group of 15 cross and upset people, pouring a certain amount of oil on it whilst giving nothing away at all. Right. I watched that and I thought, my goodness, actually, you're really quite an operator. Have you seen that particular one? Or
I haven't seen that. No.
It's very
seem to be quite straightforward. He's not afraid to call a spade, I think, in many ways. Yeah. So.
Are you left with any residual sadness that a more conservative candidate wasn't appointed? How is it? What's your own sense of discernment about what we've been given and what we've got?
Well, I mean, my opinion is not really much, but I think there was a lot of hope among a large part of the church that we were going to have someone who was going to be have the sort of prophetic voice, for example, of someone like Cardinal Seurat, who was, you know, unafraid to really speak to the world boldly with a prophetic voice and to take secularism full on, you know. But you know, maybe that wasn't the right pope for the time, you know. So I think I think we're given the pope who we need, it seems, and I think that's what's happened. I know that from hearing from, you know, some of those who were in the conclave that Cardinal Prevost wasn't their first choice, but he was the best in the circumstances, and it could have been a lot worse. I've heard. You know, the miracle, I suppose, of the conclave was that it prevented, some of these other candidates who really were considered, who would have been problematic, that it stopped them from becoming pope. So.
Without breaking confidences, do you have a? Are you able to give a sense of what the more conservative cardinals are feeling at the moment? Are they going away with their nerves calmed and some sense that the Holy Spirit has done something generous for them?
Yes, I think they are. I was talking to one who said that he felt great peace after this election. Compared to the previous one, so I think that's a sign, a positive sign, and I just think they feel that they got the best they could in the circumstances. I think that was the sense.
As a correspondent, as a close watcher of things, what's your sense that the agenda of the church is now in this new Leonine era?
Well, I think it's primarily one of trying to build bridges and to find peace, to bring unity in the church. All these things about, you know, the church has suffered in the past 12 years especially, but even before then, I think it's to try to bring things back to an even keel and stability. And I think we're going to see that. I think that'll be the hallmark of this pontificate. It's going to be... quite different to what we've had so far. I think there's a great sense that Pope Francis' pontificate was an aberration in many ways. It really was so different to anything that had been before, and was very tumultuous and revealing too. And the revealing element to it, I think, will be helpful to this Pope. It showed a lot of the problems that were under the surface before Pope Francis arrived, and he managed to stir everything up through making a mess and brought a lot of things to light, which is, I think, should be helpful to Pope Leo. I think it will help him to tackle those things because he can see them now, whereas before they were very obscured, I think.
I think that's a very wise way of ending our conversation. God works through all circumstances for good. Right. Ed, well, thank you. A wonderful conversation. Safe journey home.
Thank you. Great to talk to you again.